September 5th, 2017, 6 p.m. Go around, we've got Alderman Clismo, Alderman Hernandez, Alderman Frieders, Alderman Koch present, and staff. And Mr. Funkhauser, Alderman Funkhauser over here. Citizens' comments. Assuming nothing. Minutes for correction approval for July 5th, 2017. We did not have a meeting in August, so all in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? New business. Item 1, EDC 2017-53, building permit report for June and July 2017.
Okay, as you mentioned, we have both June and July. In June, we did substantially better than we did last year. We have the same number of permits issued in the month of June in 2016 and 2017, but the calendar year increase was about 9 more permits, or about 12%. And in the July permit summary, you'll see that the issued numbers was, again, slightly more permits in actually the month of July in 2006 than in 2017, but the calendar year increase was about 7 permits, or about 9%.
Questions? Item 2, EDC 2017-54, building inspection report for June and July of 2017.
So the June report shows that there are about 338 inspections, a bulk of which were conducted by Bob and Pete in our department, with about 90% of those permits. There is a typo in there. It says Daryl Bush did 2 inspections, but Daryl is not here anymore. It was Dave Barron's. You do by the initials, and so it accidentally typed in Daryl Bush, but it's Dave Barron's. And a bulk of those, again, were for final inspections for homes. About 50 inspections at that time were about for final inspections for homes. And in the July report, we have, again, 274 inspections were conducted. Bob and Pete conducted the majority of them, 90%, or about 241 of those. We are averaging about 6 to 7 inspections per day per inspector. So if an inspection can go between, you know, half hour to 3 hours, they're spending a majority of their time out in the field. And again, these inspections were finals as well as footing inspections.
Item 3, EDC 2017-55, property maintenance report for June and July.
Again, the June, we conducted about 106 property maintenance inspections based off complaints. 4 were adjudicated in June. If you see those, there was one for libel for 804 Morgan Street, and the others were dismissed. And then July.
Has that meter been checked at 804 Morgan?
It has been. Yeah, so we've conducted on-site visits prior to turning the water back on. There were some other claims made as part of the ticket that were necessarily related to tampering. We were investigating some other potential crimes and or potential ordinance violation issues, and none of those came up as needing a ticket after that. So. Since then, I think they've been turned off one other time just for normal non-payment bill, but nothing that's been out of the ordinary in the past past few weeks.
Thank you.
In July, we had less property maintenance violations. We had 44 that we went out and inspected. 10 of those complaints were heard in July as well, and then all of them were dismissed except for the 1690 Cannonball Trail, which was found liable, and the 977 North Carlisle, which was a developer found liable, and they have made payment.
Any questions? Okay. Item 4, EDC 2017-56, Economic Development Update.
Hello. So, you may have heard, I've been working with a very solid entrepreneur who is interested in Yorkville and building a new restaurant along the Fox River. And very shortly we will have their formal application into the city, and as soon as we have that, then we'll be able to divulge much more information. But I can tell you that the person has a very strong knowledge of being a restaurateur and also of the environment. So it's a kind of a unique opportunity for our community. And
did you say on the river?
On the river. They have the property under contract at this time.
Oh.
So,
take that north side.
It's on the north side of the river.
We don't know what side of
the river. It's going to be in the south side.
Go on late.
Damn you, Northside!
So I would actually hope that by Friday we will have this formal application. And timetable will be moving very quickly. His intention is to really get all of the moving parts completed, this cold weather opportunity, and then literally break ground in the spring. So a really neat addition to Yorkville. I know you can read my report, but I wanted to also talk briefly about Dairy Queen. It really is quite an accomplishment that Avni and Barry Patel have done. They are the only Dairy Queen in the state of Illinois that is officially a training facility. And actually, they signed a contract today with Hampton Inn. It's going to create about 750 stays a year in our hotels because they will be having people come from all over. And training, whether they be actually other people that have bought franchises, corporate consultants, they're going to be the store. So he has a lot to say about them as operators. He has a lot to say about Yorkville. He has a lot to say about what that store is doing, because it has to be to a certain level. We've been working at it for months, going through the process of getting them approved for this. They're very excited. So Hampton Inn's very excited as well, because they signed the contract. Also, you know, Kendall Marketplace, we keep moving along, so hopefully the local builder that's going to be buying the 28th single family lot should hopefully close by the end of the month, which will get things moving there. Junior Box, still working through that process. Alex is kind of really focused now. We met with another specialist on restaurants, and really kind of focusing on maybe perhaps building a multi-use building and trying to land some restaurants that would be renters. An example would be like a sandwich shop, or, you know, just to kind of get things going. So I can see that happening certainly by spring. And, you know, there's a lot of interest in Yorkville. Lots of stuff is going on regarding some other sites in Yorkville, whether they be on 34 or 47. So, you know, I would say stay tuned, because there's a lot of moving parts right now with negotiations on properties on both of those streets. But both of those are north of the river that are happening. So, Gopher Sports, I believe this week is going to be a big installation for her, where something's going to be raised. So you might want to take a ride over there and check it out. I think it's Wednesday. I think it's actually tomorrow is the day that big erecting of the trusses are going to be happening. So pretty exciting. The Brummels are very excited about that. So basically that's what I have. And if you have any other questions.
Just a quick update too on the Go For It Sports project. We did finally come to a verbal agreement with the developer there for an easement, an access agreement for their entrance off of Galena Road that would allow us to then access our park site through Galena Road. What we found out going through the process is that neither her nor us singularly require a turn lane on Galena Road, but when you add us together, it requires a D-cell for westbound traffic going into the site. And so we think it's reasonable for us to chip in half the cost of that. And so we've got an easement agreement that allows us to use her portion of the driveway. She would install all of it up front, but then we reimburse her half of the cost, up to $50,000. We think it could be less than $100,000 in total. And then would control who maintains the remainder of the driveway as it leads up to our site. So that, just because of timing considerations, might be on next city council agenda for Tuesday night.
Excellent.
That'll be huge. Parking over there.
Good.
Okay. So, I'm going to continue on now. Sorry. So the gentleman that I've been working with, I have a couple articles about him that I wanted to share with you. So it's the owner of Fisherman's Inn. His name is Mark Sutton. Mark is actually also the owner of NCAP, which many of you may have heard of, and I printed out some information about that company as well to talk about the knowledge that he brings with mitigation on banks of rivers and all that good stuff. So what had happened was, so I've been working with Mark, and literally Friday morning I was sitting in a doctor's office, and there was a magazine sitting there. It was called Northwest Business Magazine. And I opened it up, and there's an article in there about him and his wife. And I was like, I texted him, I was like, oh, I'm sitting in this doctor's office, and there's an article about you. And it's a really nice article, kind of really telling the story about how he and his wife is actually the niece of the man that originally owned the Fisherman's Inn, and how it was a labor of love, and they've taken this 20 acres. And they're open on, it's a wedding venue. Fisherman's Inn is a wedding venue. They're open on Thursday nights until October 5th. As like a patio bar. They have a limited menu. So on Thursdays only, you can go there, you can sit outside, walk around the grounds, have a nice little meal, and there's live music as well. And so I wanted to provide each of you with an article about Mark and Patty.
That's my first restaurant, Zach.
I love.
And if you see it now, you can be amazed at what he's done and the amount of that he has put into it. Energy, love.
So that was the first contact you had with him? Texting him from the doctor's office?
No.
Oh, I didn't think so. Well, I mean, you can get this whole thing rolling in York real well.
So she's Ralph's niece?
She's Ralph's niece, yes.
Wow. And you've been working with him, and then you've seen this article.
Yeah, I happened to just be in the doctor's office on Friday, and when I spotted this article, I was like, wow, this is a really neat article. And and I said, you know, would it be okay for me to share this? Because I think it really does say a lot about you and who you are. And you guys can share one. Maybe somebody has some sort of these. Okay, anyway. Does anybody else need one? I have somehow an extra one of these without an end cap. So anyway, I've been working with him, and it was like a coincidence that, you know, here I was in this doctor's office and saw this article. And I thought it was really well done. It's from this year, and it just kind of tells the story of who they are and you know, how they put this together. So, you know, again, that is a wedding venue that is open on Thursdays. He likes the idea of having a restaurant, and so now he would have this as a restaurant. There could be a small party room like Blackstone has or like Lakeview has, but this is a restaurant that he's trying to get. So,
might there be succulent shrimp?
There might be succulent shrimp. So, actually, they have succulent shrimp on Thursday nights. So, I thought it was kind of an interesting way for you to go. I'll get introduced to Mark and Patty and his other company. And you, many of you may know his other company. So. Okay? So, stay tuned. Great things happen.
Any other questions? Item 5, EDC 2017-57 Overlay District RFP.
Okay, so staff has been working since we adopted our comprehensive plan, our award-winning comprehensive plan, we've been working on the action items to get some of these goals implemented, and one of those goals was to focus on downtown, and as part of that, to create a downtown overlay district that's going to have some streetscape master planning elements to it. And a big component of that is form-based code, which we'll get into more when we get this RFP off the ground. What we're trying to do is start this RFP so that we can get qualified professionals to help us come in and to create these layers of elements that would attract a downtown environment that we're looking for. To create it, to attract other businesses to come in there. So a part of that would be streetscape appearance, facilitating rehabilitation and facade improvements, gateway finding, wayfinding, materials, landscaping. And our RFP goes through all those criteria and asks for submittals. The schedule that we're looking at is, of course, today EDC. These dates have changed in here. City Council, we're hoping to get it on the September 12th City Council. Publish the RFP on September 15th. The submittal deadline would be October 6th. We'd have a review deadline of October 20th at a staff level review, and then we conduct interviews the last week in October. So that'd be October 23rd to the 27th, and then we'll pick back up on the original plan dates of November 7th for EDC coming back to award the contract, and then November 14th with City Council. So if you have any questions on any of the elements that we're looking for in the plan, just let me know. When it goes to City Council, we'll have those dates updated for you as well as in the proposal itself.
One thing I noticed on the cover of the RFP, all three of these things are no longer parts of Yorkville. Caboose is gone. The Klein is at least construction's done. There's nothing in the center behind Rowdy's. And then this is the park by my house with that little leaf. That's been knocked out for years. So will this RFP kind of help us gain some sort of identity? Because it seems like everything that we used to have is like
That's the point, to create an identity, to create a sense of space. So you look at different elements from the ground itself, with landscaping, to the facades of building, to the massing of buildings. Do we want to have a very vertical downtown? Do we want to have height differentials? Do we, you know, what are we trying to accomplish? And this is what this RFP would do, and what we would end up doing with the results of that is codifying it in our ordinance so that when development does come, it would be required to meet. And these aren't just, oh, here's a plan on, you know, on the shelf, and we hope you design this way. This would be part of the code.
It's like the wayfinding stuff, we talked about that when you were doing the Yorkville plan.
Yes.
And it seems like you have all of this huge information. You break down Yorkville into all these different areas. But there's nothing cohesive besides the fact that we're the Foxes from the high school. And that's the only thing in Yorkville that's like,
that sets us
that you think of, which is a big red Y, which is funny because I often ask myself, what are we, like, besides a big red Y? So that's like every time that we do one of these things, I'm like, is it going to give us an identity? Because all we have right now are these fractured ideas, and there's nothing that says quintessential Yorkville.
And this is what this plan hopes to do, at least for the downtown.
Well, we need something.
So, the buildings next to the Caboose, would the RFP have something to do to upgrade them, or?
So, what the RFP would do, it would hire a professional to come in to survey all, in, you know, what we have existing, what our plan has, and to create 3D approvals of design. So, it's not necessarily this is what this building is going to become. It gives us a basis for how we would design our downtown. When developers come in, this is the form that we're looking for. These are elements that we're looking for in your design, and then they would incorporate that and interpret those in the way that they fit. As far as those silos in the plan itself, the Yorkville plan, it did have utilizing those for graphic art to bring into the downtown. And that could be interim use until such time they may be removed.
So one of the questions I had, so say there's a guy that owns a whole bunch of property behind Rowdy's and there's nothing there right now except a bunch of foundations. If he designs something and gets approval before we are anywhere close to having this process finished, and the two ideas don't really line up, what do you lean towards? Your idea that isn't flushed out, or do you let the guy with money who's building something kind of take the lead?
So the consultant and myself would work with what we know is coming in and to incorporate that into the design.
Okay.
So this is a 6-month time frame once we award the contract. So we would be looking at early summer to have this in place. Don't know if that would have an impact on the time frame of what's going to happen here.
I don't think the project would be close to development by that point.
I don't think so either.
It's probably in a longer time frame. And then two, the other card you've got to play is, there is a TIF agreement for the current property owner of that property, but there's no approved plan. Mm-hmm. So in order to get any TIF assistance, he would have to come forward to present to you a plan associated with a TIF incentive down the line. Okay. So
we do have some leverage as far
as
approving or basically saying no, come back to that.
Correct, yes. Yeah, the actual inclusion of a plan into a TIF agreement is, fairly wide discretion for a municipality. Mm-hmm. And this agreement is unique because it kind of set the financial parameters in play for a normal project. With that project, given the brownfields and some other things down there, it may not have a normal incentive, but that's another conversation from down the road, too. But you would still have to say, this is what I want to do, and I think that it's, a good project, and here's what we want it to look like, and then you would have some wide discretion to be able to talk about the design features if we don't have an overlay district in place, or to present those to him at that point if we do have them in place.
So I guess this kind of coincides with the TIF discussion, too, because if we have these buildings that are going to be making upgrades to match what our downtown overlay district is going to basically require of building owners, there are some buildings that are in the downtown that are included in the TIF and some that aren't, but yet all would be
subject
to improvements based upon the decisions that we make out of this RFP. So, number one, I don't want to exclude anyone from basically having input on what, because when I read this and it says historical and architectural, what? The only thing that was architectural downtown, from my layman's perspective, is already been painted over or changed already. I don't see anything that's quintessential Yorkville or that's, a bohemian building, random stuff like that. So I don't want to limit the scope of the RFP by having a discussion on TIF that excludes some people from being able to upgrade their building using funds from a matching pool, if that makes sense.
Sure. And I would assume that part of the process would be identification of geographic boundaries of the overlay district.
Yes.
And whether that aligns with the TIF is a question that would be fleshed out with the process.
It's within the TIF. It's the same boundaries of, the hydraulic to the north of the river, basically the river, and then south it would go as far as Fox.
Yeah.
And then the two front.
So the overlay district is essentially the TIF district, that there's some.
It's within.
Okay.
It's within. It's not the entire TIF, it's just within.
Okay.
And then there'll be a lot of public outreach to the property owners within the downtown. So it will not be a plan done, in silo inside of the city and not have input on those property from those property owners.
I just don't want to limit someone who currently owns property the ability from having input on something what they have to be held to the standard. I just think that's kind of what we're already used to. So.
One question about the boundary. Does the consultant have the ability to recommend changes to the boundary?
Yes.
Okay. In terms of engagement, I know that there's some comments about there for the citizen property owners. Do we have any, or does staff have any recommendation on what they would like to see for stakeholder meetings, how many, what type of meetings, or is it we just going to be open-ended?
We're leaving it open-ended because we do have a lot of opinions on the deliverables that we want. We want 3D modeling. We want massing. We want those types of things. So we'll leave it up to the respondent to provide us with different options because we're leaving it open. We may have come up with a different idea than we would have ever thought for, engagement. So.
And through the RFP, as it's also, if we as a council decide that we'd like more engagement than last week, we talked about that.
Absolutely.
Are we planning just one committee, one council type of review meetings for these? proposal, or is that yet to be determined?
When we lay out a timeline, we always just give the right. one meeting and then the second one. So if it takes multiple meetings, we right. just extend the timeline out.
Okay.
But we are planning to come back to EDC.
And then relating to review of submissions, cost effectiveness and cost controls. So those are two different line items. We're not expecting them to provide a cost estimate on what it would take to start to implement some of the elements. We're just looking for cost effectiveness and cost control for their actual contract and performance within those agreements.
Correct.
Okay. Anything else?
No.
Any other questions?
We did have $25,000 budget.
Yes.
In this fiscal year, so to the extent that it moves forward, we always can amend that in the budget process. And because of that, we would expect City Council to approve it, which is why we built it into the timeline.
Right.
Everybody should be aware, though, that the governor did sign a bill that raises the local government purchasing authority from $20,000 to $25,000. Without City Council approval, if your code allows it. So our code is currently at 20, and we are preparing an amendment for the admin committee meeting in 2 weeks to raise that to match the state level. So to the extent that you approve that, even though debt, you know, the submittals may come in less than the budget amount, less that statutory amount, our intent would still be to have this approved by City Council just because of the, you know, the high level of buy-in that's required for it.
Item 6, EDC 2017-58, Downtown TIF Districts. There's four components to that.
Sure, you want to start or you want me to...
I'll do the easy stuff first on the extension of the TIF. So I've got the one page...
Is this real long?
It probably will be, yeah. Mm-hmm. 21 to 30 minutes.
Queen, if you okay?
I'm okay.
Okay. Can we switch gears then, and we'll take item 7, EDC 2017-59, sidewalk slash parlor cafe ordinance.
Sidewalk cafe and parklets. This was started with a query from a business wanting to do some type of outdoor seating area, but the area was going to be in the public way, which is the sidewalk. Right now, we have ordinances that allow for patio-type uses, but they've always occurred on private property. The city had not had to get involved or engaged in any public property for those uses. Best planning practices, these are optimal for creating a vibrant downtown, having sidewalk cafes, having bodies and people moving on the sidewalk within the downtown. And so staff felt this was a good opportunity to not only put in a public sidewalk cafe, but also a parklet. And if you're not familiar with a parklet, parklets are similar to sidewalk cafes, but they occur when there's not enough public space on the sidewalk. So you have to have at least a 5-foot area of traversing for ADA compliances for people to walk by. So some area sidewalks aren't conducive to have a patio area and then have that 5-foot. So what people have begun to do is to build out that dining space in an unused parking space. And it's secured, and there's images in there for you to look at.
And, like a little island.
Yeah, it's a little island. And sometimes you get locations where there's not a lot of street parking taking place, and so you have available real estate to use for those types of activities. So what we tried to do was we tried to craft an ordinance that allowed for this type of use that didn't impede within the public way, so they won't happen in areas, say, where there's a bike path or anything like that. But and these eating areas will be temporary, and they'll happen during the establishment's business hours, and at the end of the day, those things that are not permanent will then come inside. And things that are permanent will be left up. I mean, we tried to get a little bit more in-depth in the aesthetic components, what would be permitted, what wouldn't be permitted. We're not envisioning patio chairs, like plastic patio chairs.
I saw the word flimsy.
Yes, flimsy.
I thought that
we want something
descriptive.
Yes. We could add pictures of what we don't want, but we're trying to have people use their best judgment, but we're actually looking for something that is inviting and create people wanting to stay in the downtown. So if you have any questions, we're actually going to have a separate component to this, which would be another liquor license category, and that will be coming before the public, I'm sorry, the what's that? Public Safety Committee. I was thinking of Public Works. Public Safety Committee.
So this, so I'm a big fan of like what Plainfield's done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part. Is it similar? Because I know we've been out there at 10 in the morning and eating there right on the street. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised how many people out do that also.
It's exactly what Plainfield has. Plainfield right now is only utilizing the sidewalk cafe. But I haven't seen a lot of suburban communities use the parklets because there's more happening in urban areas, but I think it would be a good opportunity to test them out. They will not occur on like 47 or 34 state roadways, but it'll occur on some.
I hope.
Right.
Yeah. That would be. But like now, what about narrow streets though? Can you do something like that on a street that's not really wide?
It would be on a case-by-case basis because you'll have to get a permit. So staff will come and we'll look at the plan, make sure that they're not too close to the intersection, there's not heavily trafficked areas, but there could be some areas where this could potentially work.
Because realistic, we're only looking at parklets because our sidewalks won't accommodate 5-foot clearance with seating areas.
Right now,
some might. So there's some that have been built out a little bit just recently, and one is the corner of Van Emmon and 47. That corner has been built out a little bit, so I think there's like 16 to 18 feet where you can have that occur. You might have some areas that maybe 8 feet, so they can go out about 3 feet and just have maybe about 4 tables or, you know, 2 tables and 4 chairs. So just something to create an outdoor presence along the street.
Yeah, two of the things that kind of caught my eye is, one, we have a time permit from April 1st to October 31st.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I lived the majority of my 20s in bars, you know, mm-hmm. smoky bars, and only until 08 has smoking not been allowed inside. So one of the things that when you have a limit on here, I can see this as kind of making a smoking corral for a lot of people, and they smoke 12 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. Also, there's this thing called climate change, and it's 75 degrees in February. So I think that putting it in between April and October is a little bit limiting because I maybe could say weather permitting. I just think that's a little restrictive. Also, the propane heaters that look like mushrooms, those mm-hmm. things are pretty powerful. And if people want to stand outside and smoke and be able to hold their cocktail, I'm kind of open to letting them do that. Because maybe they'll spend more money when they go back inside and realize they shouldn't be smoking cigarettes in the first place. And then the other thing, it had a prohibited item.
Ban smoking.
This is America, bro. You can do it. You can kill yourself whoever you want, whether it's slowly or, you know.
That's funny because I thought we did ban smoking.
Inside.
And near an entrance.
Right. It has to be 20 feet away from the entrance.
In our parks.
Absolutely.
We should not inside.
No, but outside of businesses where they're serving alcohol.
Yeah, but you can easily say there's no smoking in a patio area or a parklet.
That's another thing that you could do, yeah. But I'm just saying, rather than limiting something, make it on either, like you said, a case-by-case basis or allow
people
to have
to smoke. What if I
want
to see it in a park later, sit outside, why do I have to smell somebody else's smoke?
Yeah. I say that every time I drive to work and there's a smoker in front of me. Freedom is a slippery slope.
I would like to see something about smoking being banned in the park in the outdoor smoking areas.
I guess
we can duke it out with the votes.
I guess that's level two. The other thing, as far as prohibited items, they have shelves, serving stations, and they say loudspeakers. I know that all speakers are basically considered loud depending on how they're used, but a lot of the, like, and behind Crusade, they got speakers in the ceiling and stuff. Mm-hmm. Not that they would have that, you know, mounted over a parklet, but is that something that would also be on a case-by-case basis if somebody wanted to have a speaker outside?
Well, there's overlapping noise regulations, mm-hmm. too.
Right.
Not only with general noise, but within the patio and outdoor liquor license, depending on how we mold these two license sections together,
mm-hmm.
That already cover that too. So the outdoor patio liquor license already has restrictions on time, decibel levels,
mm-hmm.
And amplification rules. So it's something that we could maybe even adopt that, just mimic them between the two sections, depending on how the ultimate ordinance is up.
So it wouldn't say you can't have a loudspeaker, just say you have to fall underneath the noise ordinance.
Yeah, adhere to the noise ordinance, so you want to remove
it. Yeah, because I can see some restaurants that have some kind of ambient.
Yep. Okay. As long as it's within reason, it'd be fine.
No, I mean, I guess we just have to tighten up, location-wise, where we can put these. I mean, there's high-traffic areas. We're not like Plainfield, where there's stop signs and speed bumps, and you're doing 20 miles an hour going to downtown Springfield. We're doing 50 miles per hour going to your building. You shouldn't be, but that's what people are doing.
Right.
Well, I know what the speed limit is.
Right, exactly.
I'm just saying what people actually do is different than what the speed limit actually is. So, I mean, that's just my only concern. Where we put these things just have to be safe and, semi-trucks kick up rocks and this and that, and if you're sitting there, that could be a very uncomfortable experience.
And then regarding the permanence of the structures, whatever they make, in Geneva on 3rd, there's a couple of restaurants that made up they look like pallets, but they're really not. Like, they set them up so that they can kind of move them, but they leave them out at night, and then they bring them in when they're going to get damaged, whether by rain or by snow or by wind or whatever. Is this something where you're going to... whatever they put up, you have to approve, of course, but is it something that they have to then haul in every night, or how do you guys are going to work it?
Only the temporary removable items, nothing that's a fix would have to be. So we're really thinking just the tables and the chairs come in, the barriers stay up, the platforms stay up, and then you bring out the tables and the chairs. The issue is you just don't want all this stuff, if it's windy, blowing.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Right.
A week ago, we were up in Geneva, and there was some kind of event going on, and actually put... the portable pop-up tents.
Mm-hmm.
The tent was actually to the edge of the street, over the sidewalk, and into their stuff.
Oh, cool.
So you literally had to walk under their tent when you went down the street. I don't know if they allowed that, or I thought it was kind of different when I seen it. I was right over the sidewalk.
Yeah.
They went right to the street with it. These were big ones, too. So it kind of captures the audience.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that was nice. It's nice very much.
The timing. The concern I have with that allowing it year round is these are public ways for snow plowing. We're going to have some potential conflicts with it. And I understand, they're going to probably be out there at 18, but if they're allowed to keep structures out there in winter, there's potential for damage and conflicts.
Sure.
That'd be my concern. Depending on what type it is, do we have a problem with snow removal? Because we're also required to remove snow from the adjacent parking spaces.
Yeah.
So that makes it more work for staff tacking things up. I want to keep that in mind when we're thinking about the timing.
Maybe it would require coordination. That's a good point.
Yeah, require that or
maybe a clause if there's damage too.
Indemnification, we're not responsible for damage during snow plowing if we allow it year round. I like the limited time frame. At least initially. Maybe there's good cause later to bring it. I agree with Carlo on the potential restriction of smoking adjacent to it. I think that's a good thing. In terms of the quantity, they say that it's a minimum of one parking space, but it could be the entire width of it. So if you have a building that takes up 10 parking spaces, I don't know of any that exist in that. But if it was 10 parking spaces, could they take all 10, or is there a consideration of how much space is taken? It's not in the ordinance.
Correct.
So is there a consideration given to the amount of parking being removed?
Yes. It cannot take up more than the minimum required. So if there's a requirement for five stalls and they only have six, then they only can have the parklet in one stall.
And do we have the flexibility to further restrict, say, it is they can have five out of the six? Can we say we're only going to let you have three?
Yes. And it's in there, the community development director or designee.
Yes, final. Mm-hmm. Okay, I just want to make sure that we have that ability. Is that good?
Yeah, I'd like to see it.
So it'll have to go to the October 11th Planning and Zoning Commission meeting for a public hearing, because we are amending the zoning ordinance as part of this, and it'll go back to City Council.
Is this going to also public safety or not?
Yes.
Okay, so I thought.
Yes, October-ish.
Anything else on this?
No, sir.
Okay. Then we'll go back. to item 6, last item of EDC 2017-58, Downtown Civ District.
Okay, so back to the cover memo on the extension of the existing TIF districts. Just a couple things to update since the last meeting that we had a couple months ago. We ended up delaying our timeline just a little bit so that we could get all the reports in front of everybody. So we haven't notified the taxing entities yet, and we also have not sent them any formal notices or published the, I think it's called the public notice for interested persons, where you basically just contact us and get put on a registry to receive updates as we move through the process. That's like kind of the first public facing thing that we'll do. So we were going to wait for this meeting here and make sure everybody's generally okay with the process and the boundaries, and then kickstart the notification to the taxing entities now, and then the public notice for interested parties or notice would go out I think later on this week too. So and then the other thing that's changed since last month was Kathy's initial opinion was that the ordinance deleting the properties from the original TIF had to be done basically like now, had to be done before you start the process. She's since taken a look at different things and has come to the conclusion that you don't have to do it immediately when you start, as long as you do it, you know, midway through the process before it's like, you know, all the way done and then you're deleting it. So it gives us some ability, whether we change our mind or the taxing entities object to the extension of the first one, to make a decision as to whether it's easier or even advantageous for us to pull out properties of the first TIF and place them into the second TIF. So, you know, just the boundaries that we've drawn up now, although they can be changed really almost at any date throughout the process, there are some properties that are in an existing TIF agreement, and I think one of which has an approved plan, and then there's a few that don't have an approved plan, but they've got inducement resolutions on them. So the process to transfer, I guess, effectively one from one TIF to the other under a TIF agreement is a little complex. So Kathy was saying that if we can avoid that, we should, but if there's an economic reason to do so, then that'd be okay. So so we've got another month or two basically to review that ordinance and then discuss it at City Council during the creation of the second TIF district. So, any questions about anything I just said? Okay. Jason's going to review the three reports and plans that are in the packet.
Yeah, and originally, too, we were just going to do the eligibility report and the housing study, but since last meeting got canceled, Kathy finished the redevelopment plan. So these are all three parts. This is the whole kit and caboodle of everything we need. And I'll go over very briefly what each part goes over. I don't need to bore you with every single detail. We all know why we're doing this and the summary behind it. Can everybody kind of see the colors on that map?
Or
one side, yeah.
There we go.
So, where's my mouse? Oh, no. Okay, so everything in the, well, it looks brown up here, but this is all the original TIF and what will be staying in TIF number one. Everything in red on the inside of this black boundary is getting removed from TIF one. It would be established in TIF 2, and all the blues in here would be additional parcels that we thought would be good additions, adding as a scope to things that could need redevelopment. So the big black outline would be the new TIF number 2. And it's about 60 parcels removed from TIF 1 to TIF 2, and TIF 2 has about 120 parcels in it. So we'll just move right into the eligibility report. The eligibility report, per the Act, there are 14 different criteria. The first one is always the age of buildings. If more than 50% of your buildings are 35 structures within, not just on parcels, but all structures, if they're 35 years or more in age, you only need to hit 3 out of the next 13 criteria. If all the buildings are newer, you need 5. And you really want those buildings to be older, because at 35 years older, you only need 3, so it's easier, and then it's called a conservation area, which is important. But me and Vanessa was our planning intern back in July. We conducted a full eligibility and fieldwork survey, walked around downtown, took pictures, filled out this report, and when it was all said and done, more than 30, almost 80% of the buildings were older than 35 years, then we hit 5 out of the 13 criteria. It's great to hit more than you need, because if somebody starts arguing, oh, this one doesn't fit, and you still have enough to qualify the TIF. The ones we hit, deterioration of buildings and site, obsolescence, economic and functional, and obsolescence is meaning the original uses have fallen out of what they could be used for today, and the platting and ways things are laid out. There's a lot of legally nonconforming structures that wouldn't meet today's standards. So those were all considered obsolete. Inadequate utilities, after talking with Eric and Brad, the area is woefully underserved for water, sanitary sewer, and storm sewer. Lack of community planning, we hit this one just by basically if the area was laid out before any comprehensive plan or strategic plan was ever made. Our first comprehensive plan was 1974, and obviously all this is from 100 years ago, so we got that one. And then finally, the decline in EAV, which actually kind of is what spurred the whole TIF number 2. It had gone down in 3 of the past 5 years, so we hit that criteria as well. So the eligibility report shows pictures and extra details. There's actually a chart at the end that shows pin by pin which criteria for each parcel hit. So with that said, the eligibility report supports the creation of a TIF 2, as this is a conservation area. This is a place that needs redevelopment, and it is lacking basic things. Moving on to the housing study, this is required by the TIF Act. If you are planning in the redevelopment plan to dislocate over 10 units, or if there's more than 75 dwelling units within the area. During our field survey, we saw 102 dwelling units. So automatically that triggered that we must conduct a housing study. Basically, the housing study just makes you take stock of all the units and using census data to see who's living there, economic, racial, and just basic demographics of the area. And then it allows you to do a relocation plan if you're planning to get things replaced. And in our redevelopment plan, there's attachments for existing land uses. You can see there's actually a good amount of residential parcels in here. Now flip to our future land use, showing that a lot of them, while are staying, there's some mostly kind of by the old Second Bank that are switching over to institutional uses. And we just used future land uses from the comp plan to determine how things are going to change. So this is what's existing there, and this is how it's going to be. So basically in the housing study, it asks to make sure there's a relocation plan. You have to find housing currently in the area with typical sales and rents to what's typical if these things got removed. And then it also states, you know, if for any purpose the city were to buy someone's house and remove them from it, with TIF dollars, you'd have to replace them. It's the same as if we did it without a TIF. It's just you have to state it in your housing study that you're going to follow that federal statute. So really the housing study is more just showing that there's available housing elsewhere nearby. No one's going to get uprooted and have nowhere to live.
Does Jackie know?
About the proposed boundaries?
She's going to be institutional use when she's...
Yeah, she did pose some questions just about the legality of it, and you know, making sure that she was you know, removing herself from the conversation if needed. And I know that Kathy had talked to her, and I don't remember the exact boundaries of what is and isn't allowed. If I remember correctly, I believe she's allowed to participate and vote on it. I think the issue becomes if she ever were to redevelop the property herself, then she would have to,
right,
you know, may not be eligible for TIF assistance or may have to do something else in order to
Mm-hmm. And again, this isn't a concrete, just like the comprehensive plan is a guideline for future TIF development. If something came up and a commercial development wanted to go there, it would be up to the discretion.
Yeah. Just west of some of their new shopping area, a lot of the old homes that kind of look like mm-hmm. Jackie's are all like architecture offices or something mm-hmm. like that. So it's not absolutely out of the question visually. Mm-hmm. I just think it's interesting that, oh, Jackie's house is purple.
Yeah. For the most part, too, with comprehensive plan, and now we own the old second area, that was going to be an institutional, campus. Eventually, if that pans out, great. If it doesn't, there are always more opportunities for something else. And then moving on to the redevelopment plan, Kathy put this together. This is like the meat of the actual TIF because it really just talks about what are we really trying to accomplish here. It really just states the purpose of the redevelopment. Why are we putting a TIF here? It gives out a lot of goals and objectives of things we'd like to see in the TIF. It goes over what eligible activities and eligible costs are when we go into a negotiation. Some things we're going to say, yes, we can spend TIF dollars on. Some things you're not allowed to. So it kind of states of all the things we want to do. It also goes through a list of fiscal impacts and all the taxing bodies. Typically with TIFs, the big one is the school districts usually have, especially if there's residential components to the TIF, you're going to be adding children. They're not going to see those tax dollars for the next 23 years. There is a budget already in place within the TIF as reimbursement if there are added children. I know there's a whole calculation and summary that I'm sure Kathy used. And then throughout it goes through proposed costs and budgets for different projects. And that's just kind of stating, again, it's a guideline of things we want to see and do, and it gives us an estimated, are we going to see these costs when we get these TIF dollars in the budget? So, so that was just a pretty quick overview of everything. If you have any specific questions about specific things you'd like to see changed or questions on how we came up with something, just ask, and we're just really looking for feedback on the whole project.
Yeah, I got a quick question. On the redevelopment project area goals, number one is preservation of the history of the city through retention of historic structures. Mm-hmm. What is considered a historic structure outside of the block between Hydraulic and Van Emmon on 47? Is there anything that you can think of off the top of your head?
Well, the definition from the state preservation is anything over 50 years old and or has significant historical value, like a person that was there, an event that happened at that location. So we have to do a little bit of research. But obviously, all of those locations are older than 50 years old.
Yeah,
so unless there's something...
The courthouse.
That had historical
the county sold it.
Impact, we can definitely...
So you kind of just put it in there just to cover the
base. As a blanket, yeah.
In Kendall County, they don't really have a board anymore, but they used to have a historical preservation committee that would go around the county looking at things. It doesn't necessarily hold a ton of weight, but it's something to always think about, and I know they still have meetings and things, even though the committee's expanded. But to check, if something big came in downtown Yorkville, somebody might come up from Kendall County saying, hey, we've marked this as historical. We really want you to think about it.
Some of those foundations.
The Button Factory building is
part
of it, sort of kind of old. That's been a long
time. It's just like when you're doing something like this that's so all-encompassing. Mm-hmm. For me, just to be able to process it, I need to be able to have these little bookmarks in my head. And that's one of them where I'm like, what are we talking about besides the immediate block?
As just a generality on the TIF Act. A lot of the TIF Act is vague and a little open-ended. Mm-hmm. Just like when doing the eligibility report, a big thing we get is deterioration. And a resident will come and say, hey, why'd you say my driveway's deteriorated? It's like, well, there's a crack. Mm-hmm. They're like, really? And it's like, that's what it says, cracks. Like, well, it may just be one and some weeds are growing, So it's very vague and broad. And then when you're doing a redevelopment plan, you kind of follow suit with saying, we want to have all our bases covered.
Right. All right. And then one other question was on the estimated redevelopment project costs.
Mm-hmm.
It has that little budget. Not little budget. It's actually quite lengthy. But studies, surveys, marketing, assembly costs, rehabilitation, construction, training, job training, financing, all of those things equaling roughly, you know, $14 million. Is that for the entire life of the TIF? That's what you assume right now the TIF can handle, generate?
Handle, yeah.
Okay. And then is, that, it's like a rolling estimated. Number? Okay. But that's like a rolling number that, like, is there ever a time, say, 4 years into the TIF when you reassess what the potential value or potential...
I don't believe you're required to, like, do like a halfway point study and then like recertify what the number is, as much as you have to do reports every year into I forget which entity it is, the state, and then you know, just your annual budget that's got the TIF in there. So as long as you follow that, I mean, so like the theoretical is if you know, a giant tower gets put in the downtown for some reason and it generates $1 billion in increment or something, you know, you're TIF budget is going to go through the roof, obviously. And so there's nothing that's like a hard cap that makes you say, oh, we can't do this because we had only assumed there'd be $50 million in redevelopment and we've actually been $1 billion.
Right, I guess that's what I'm getting at. Like, right. is the 14 your estimate right now based on what's there existing?
Yeah, it's a reasonable estimate.
But then that number is kind of rolling because, as you say, if a tower gets built and we got 17 stories or something and we're making, you know,
or go the other way.
Yeah.
The current the way. There wasn't $14 million.
But I'm just, you have that number,
right.
Is everything, I know that it's an estimate, but like, is there something that ties you to that number, good or bad?
Nope.
Thank you.
We'd be in a lot of trouble with the current TIF.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. Number,
yeah.
Like, what are we redigging the same hole? And that's why I'm just trying to make
we had that in Countryside, right? Originally, Countryside had a tough spell there, right? Until now, that's going to be
definitely. Yeah, right, I mean, their project budget, I'm sure, was much higher than what's actually been put into it so far.
Right.
And these are all the same costs. I think one of them might have changed in the past 10 years since we did our last TIF, but it is basically by the book what we did with the first TIF in the downtown.
Thank you.
Estimate. You're saying that is based on the original TIF estimates. Is there a breakdown that supports how we got to the $14 million?
It's not based on what we thought the first TIF would do, because this is a separate study, so we just look at the areas, and I don't know how you and Kathy came up with the numbers.
Yeah, like, I'd have to talk to her.
Support to those numbers.
Yeah, so that's based on her experience and doing multiple other TIFs. So I don't know what off the top of my head what criteria she used. But
if we can get something, if some of those are, you know, municipal items in there that I would like to know, you know, do they have a foundation to the numbers?
Yeah, I assume that had something to do with that there per se and not just a general number.
I'm sure that that was a portion of it, but my guess is it had to do with land area and current EAV of the project. So,
yeah, for the most part, because we had in the comprehensive plan, you know, ideas and plans for several of these blocks. I'm sure she looked at the current EAVs and possible developments that could happen, looked at those EAVs, and probably grabbed numbers for that.
She just didn't ask for any data from us on what we had given her just in general. So, and again, it doesn't commit you to do anything. You're just required to give the estimated cost as part of the study. So, just timeline and process. So there's not actually a city council vote that's required on this until what we're currently targeting for October 10th. Okay. So after this meeting, we'd be publishing the Notice of Interested Parties Registry, which I mentioned. We'd be sending a notice to the taxing entities of a public meeting, and same for each residential address within the TIF, too. So this public meeting is it can be done in the city council meeting, and it's basically an opportunity for everybody to come and get a little bit of an overview of the study as it currently sits, so even without your formal input yet. But then also you know, just the overall plan and the process going forward. So that meeting we would expect to occur at the end of September, as long as all the notices get out. And then, so that October 10th ordinance is actually establishing the date and time of the public hearing and the Joint Review Board meeting. So the public hearing is required by law. They'd be held, let's see here.
December 12th.
Yeah, so 2 months out, basically, from when we first vote on it. And the Joint Review Board would be held in the middle of November. And the Joint Review Board is where all the taxing entities come to a meeting. They review the plan. They each actually get a voting, or they get a vote on the recommendation on the plan and the formation of the second TIF district. If they make a positive recommendation, it just gets forwarded to the City Council for review. And if it's a negative recommendation, it actually does change the voting threshold from, I believe, it's majority to a supermajority. So there is formal process, too. So after this meeting, as long as everybody's okay with it, we would intend to send out the notices of the first informal public meeting and then the notices to the taxing entities about that meeting. But then also just an invitation for me to go and the mayor to go and Lynn to go to talk about the extension of the first TIF as well.
So you'll get some feedback prior to their own voting at that point if they're going to be on board or not. Is it tax advice?
I would expect some people might give me feedback. Some may not know. And, you know, we can do with that what we will. So some may say, no, you know, I haven't polled anybody, and I don't know until we get to the meeting, and we just got to do an open session, which is fine.
So if the taxing body says no, it results in a supermajority?
Yeah. So there's two processes. So the one is the extension of the existing TIF.
Right.
So that is the one that typically everybody signs the informal letter to the state so they can introduce sole purpose legislation. The second process, which is the formal public hearing and joint review board, is part of the formation of the second TIF. That's the one that's done in November and December. They will all come to a meeting and have the chance to vote on it. And then at that point, if they actually vote it down here, that it becomes a supermajority vote for us to create the second TIF. So there's a formal process built into place for the creation of the second TIF where they would be able to formally object to it.
Okay.
The extension is a little bit more vague just because, you know, you're just looking for a letter of support to be able to take to the state for single purpose legislation.
So in those entities, what if you've got, let's say, a large number of them right off the bat are going to be against it, then
sure.
What do you do? You still proceed?
Yeah.
You need some kind of PR thing, right?
I guess my formal strategy would be, you know, let's go to a meeting and talk about it and see if we can come to an agreement, give us a chance, you know, for the extension of the first TIF. And if everybody votes it down then we'll, you know, figure out what we're doing with the formation of the second TIF as it relates to those deleted parcels. But the creation of the second TIF, that's really, you know, if everybody tells us they hate it, you know, well, my comment would still be, well, you need to go to the Joint Review Board. You need to give us the formal opportunity, you know, to present to you what the plan is, to hear your concerns, to see if we can address them, and then to take a vote. And if they at that point feel that they can't vote for it, then so be it. It just turns into a negative recommendation to the City Council for your decision making. And if it sounds complex, it is. Just because we're doing
sounds like there's a lot of players involved.
Yeah,
a lot of moving parts.
Just the timeline between trying to figure out how to do the extension of the first one at the same time as the second one has been massive amounts of time. Just trying to figure out how to give everybody adequate notice and be able to go there and, you know, not get the two issues confused. So,
yeah,
I
want to clarify one point for the notification. It's two notification processes, and it is through all landowners of each of the two, to the existing and to the proposed.
So you don't have, I don't think you have to notify the owners of the first TIF district of the extension. I think that's taxing entities only. But the creation of the second one does require anybody within the project area and within 750 feet of the TIF district. So there will be people that will get the notice of the public meeting that aren't even in the TIF district. So I don't recall off the top of my head if the 750, if that applies to the actual public notice.
That's the yeah, so for the public meeting, for the housing study and the general notice, you have to go to the taxing districts, interested persons, all the residential addresses, and the property all property owners. And then later, when you're establishing the public hearing for the whole TIF, that's the 750 feet, the residents within that 750 feet. So, discluding who's already in there, because they'll already know.
But they will be notified through that process as well, even though they're within it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, but for the extension, they will not be notified that we are pursuing this. It'll be subsequent to the start of the extension.
Correct.
How far of a difference? What do we have in the difference from when the notifications go up to when we start this process?
The first mailers will be sent here in the next week or so, and that would be for the actual public meeting, which should occur end of September, early October. But then the actual vote by City Council to start the formal process of setting the public hearing dates and the Joint Review Board meeting, that won't occur until October 10th for us. And then the notice is sent at least 45 days prior to the public hearing. Mm-hmm. So, and when the last time we did this, I recall our mailing list was 700 or 800 homes, I want to say, or mailing addresses. And there was probably 100 people that showed up to the public meeting, which we held at the old courthouse, and maybe another 50 or 60 that showed up to the formal public hearing. And I don't recall it being that bad, actually, as far as, just general distrust or not understanding the process once Kathy has walked everybody through it and kind of answered questions. So, the biggest thing for us when we did it the first time was, we're not forcing you to do anything. You don't have to sell to the city. You don't have to sell it to the developer. It's an economic development tool that if you want to use it to redevelop your property, you can, but otherwise it shouldn't have an impact on you as a person.
For the other taxing bodies, did it take any arm twisting that time? I don't really remember. It must have been before I was
there. I don't think so. Everybody, I think, elsewhere always says that the school district is, difficult to deal with just because they're the largest taxing entity. And my recollection was they were actually a willing partner, understood it from the get-go, and were really good to work with. And there's been a fair amount of board transition and administration transition over there since then. And everything else that we've had with them, they've been good partners. So hopefully they'll understand the potential benefits to them at the end of it. And if not, we'll see where that leads.
Any additional business? Meeting adjourned. 7:15.